The smoke clouds rose across the sun, plunging them into an unnatural gloom, and Zuger felt a sharp drop in his spirits at the extinction of the bright morning sun. That infernal swirling pall of dun smoke seemed to hold the world of menace. From the edge of the jesse bush broke a herd of kudu, led by a magnificent bull with his corkscrew horns laid flat along his back. He saw Zuger standing on the pinnacle of rock and snorted with alarm, swinging away out of easy shot with his cows flying big-eared and scary behind him. Their fluffy white tails flickered away amongst the mapani groves. Zuger scrambled down from his too obvious position and propped himself comfortably against the rock, checked the nipple on the cap of the sharps, and then cocked the big hammer. Ahead of the flames, a pale white dust cloud was rising over the tops of the jesse bush, and another sound was added to the roar of flames. It was a low thunder that made the earth tremble under their feet. "They are coming," Jan Sharut muttered to himself, and his little eyes sparkled. A single buffalo burst from the palisade of thorn. He was an old bull, almost bald across the shoulders and rump, the dusty grey skin crisscrossed by a thousand ancient scars and scabby with the bites of bush ticks. The big bell-shaped ears were torn and tattered, and one thickly curved horn was broken off at the tip. He came out at a crabbing gallop, dust exploding at each hoofbeat like miniature mortar bursts. He was on a line to pass the rocky redoubt at 20 paces, and Zuger let him come on to twice that distance before he threw up the sharp's rifle. He aimed at the fold of thick skin under the throat that marked the frontal aiming point for the heart and its complex of arteries and blood vessels. He hardly noticed the recoil, nor the blurt of the shot, as he watched for the strike of the lead bullet. There was a little spurt of dust off the grey hide precisely on his aiming point, and the sound of the hit was exactly like his headmaster swinging the Malacca cane against his own schoolboy backside, sharp and meaty. The bull took the bullet without a stumble or lurch. Instead, it swung towards them, and seemed immediately to double in size as it lifted its nose into the high attitude of the charge. Zuger reached for his second gun, but he groped in vain. Mark, his number two, showed the whites of his eyes in a flash of terror, let out a squawk, hurled the elephant gun aside, and went bounding away towards the Mapani Grove. The bull saw him and swerved again, thundering 10 feet past Zuger as it went after the fleeing bearer. Waving the empty sharps, Zuger shouted desperately for another rifle, but the bull was past him in a grey blur, and it caught Mark as he reached the tree line. The great bossed head dropped until the snout almost touched the earth, and then flew up again in a powerful tossing motion that bunched the muscle in the thick black neck. Mark was looking back over his shoulder, his eyes wide and glaring white in the black face. Rivulets of sweat poured down his naked back, his mouth a pink gape as he screamed. Then he was in the air, legs and arms tumbling wildly. He went up like a rag doll thrown up by a petulant child, and disappeared into the thick green canopy of Mapani foliage overhead. Without missing a stride, the bull drove on into the forest, but that was all that Zuger saw, for a cry from Sergeant Sharut made him turn again. "Here, Komala! Here they come!" Across their whole front, the earth seemed to move, as though racked by the convulsions of an earthquake. Shoulder to shoulder, nose to rump, the main herd broke from cover, flattening the thorn bush under the great wave of bodies, filling the valley from side to side. They lifted behind them a dense curtain of pale dust, from which the front ranks seemed endlessly to emerge, their great bossed heads nodding in unison as they pounded on, long silver strings of saliva dangling from open jaws as they bellowed in alarm and anger, and the roar of their hooves drowned the sound of the flames. Matthew and John, Zuger's two remaining bearers, had stood their ground, and one of them snatched away the empty sharps and thrust the thick stock of an elephant gun into Zuger's hand. The weapon seemed heavy and unbalanced after the sharps, and the sights were crudely fashioned, a blunt cone for the foresight, and a deep V for the backsight. The solid wall of bodies was bearing down upon them with frightening speed, The cows were a dark chocolate colour, and their horns were more delicately curved. The calves that raced at their flanks were sleek russet with crowns of reddish curls between the rudimentary little horn spikes. The herd was so tightly packed that it seemed impossible that they could split open to pass the rock. There was a tall, rangy cow in the leading rank, coming straight onto the Zuga. He held half a bead aiming into the centre of her chest and squeezed off the shot. The firing cap popped with a tiny puff of white smoke, and a heartbeat later the elephant gun vomited a deafening gust of powder smoke and bright flame. The burning patches went spinning away over the heads of the charging buffalo, and Zuga felt as though one of them had kicked in his shoulder. He staggered backwards, the barrel thrown high by the recoil, but the big red cow seemed to run into an invisible barrier. A quarter of a pound of mercury-hardened lead drove into her chest and brought her down in a rolling, sliding tangle of hooves and horns. "Tom Harkness, that was one of yours!" Zuga shouted, offering the kill to the memory of the old white-bearded hunter, and he grabbed the next loaded rifle. There was a prime bull, big and black, a ton of enraged bovine flesh. It had seen Zuga, and was coming in over the rocks, in a long, scrambling leap, hunting them out, so close that Zuga seemed to touch it with the gaping muzzle of the 4 to the pound. Again the great clanging burst of sound and flame and smoke, and half the bull's head flew away in a gust of bone chips and bloody fragments. It reared up on its hind legs, striking out with forehooves, and then crashed over in a cloud of dust. Impossibly, the herd split, galloping down each side of their rocky hide, a heaving, grunting, forked river of striving muscle and bone. Jan Sharoot was yipping shrilly with the fever of the chase, ducking down behind the rock to reload, biting open the paper cartridge with powder dribbling down his chin, spitting the ball into the muzzle and then plying the ramrod in a frenzy, before bobbing up again to fire into the solid, heaving press of gigantic bodies. It lasted for 2 minutes, which seemed to take a round of eternity, and then they were left choking and gasping in the swirling clouds of dust, surrounded by half a dozen huge black carcasses, with the drumbeats of the herd fading away into the Mapani forest, and a louder, more urgent din roaring on them from in front. The first tongue of heat licked across them, and Zuga heard the lock of sun-bleached hair that hung on his forehead frizzle sharply and smelt the stink of it. At the same instant, the dust cloud fell abruptly aside, and for seconds they stared at a spectacle which deprived them of power of movement. The jesse bush was not burning. It was exploding into sheets of flame. "Run!" shouted Zuga. "Get out of here!" The sleeve of his shirt charred and the air he breathed scorched his lungs painfully. As they reached the edge of the Mapani forest, the shining green leaves about their heads shriveled and yellowed, curling their edges in the heat, and Zuga felt his eyeballs drying out as the dark smoke clouds rolled over them. He knew that they were experiencing only the heat and smoke carried on the wind, but if the flames were able to jump the gap, then they were all doomed. Ahead of him, the Hottentots and the other bearers were shadowy wraiths, staggering forward, but weakened and losing direction. Then, as suddenly as they had been engulfed by them, the billowing smoke clouds lifted. The flames had not been able to jump the open ground, and the heat came only in gusts. A ray of sunshine pierced the thick gloom overhead, and a puff of sweet fresh air came through. They sucked at it gratefully, and huddled in awed silence, beating at their clothing, which still smouldered in patches. Zuga's face was blackened and blistered, and his lungs still convulsed in spasms of coughing. As he caught his breath, he grunted hoarsely. "Well, the meat is cooked already," and he pointed back at the buffalo carcasses. At that moment, something fell limply out of the dense top branches of a Mapani tree, and then picked itself up and limped painfully towards them. Zuga let out a husky growl of laughter. "Oh, thou swift of foot!" he greeted Mark the bearer, and the others took up the mockery. "When you fly, the eagles are put to shame," Yan Shirut hooted. "Your true home is in the treetops," Matthew added with relish, "with your hairy brethren." By evening they had hacked the buffalo carcasses into wet red chunks and spread these on the smoking racks. The racks were waist high, cross poles set in forked branches with a slow smoking fire of wet mapani wood smouldering under it. Here was meat for the caravan that would last them for many weeks. Camacho Pereiro had no doubts that by simply following the line of the escarpment, keeping just below the bad broken ground, he must at last cut the spoor of the caravan. 100 men in column would blaze a track that even a blind man would trip over. His certainty dwindled with each day's march through the quivering, breathless heat that seemed to rebound from black kopjes and the ironstone cliffs that glittered in the aching sunlight like the scales of some monstrous reptile. Of the men that his half-brother Alphonse had given him, he had already lost two. One had stepped on something that looked like a pile of dried leaves, but which had transformed itself instantly into 6 feet of infuriated gaboon adder, thick as a man's calf, with a repulsively beautiful diamond-patterned back and a head the size of a man's fist. The gaping mouth was a lovely shade of salmon pink, and the curved fangs 3 inches long. It had plunged them into the man's thigh, and squirted half a cupful of the most toxic venom in Africa into his bloodstream. After blowing the serpent to shreds with volleys of rifle fire, Camacho and his companions had wagered all their expectations of loot on exactly how long it would take the victim to die. Camacho, the only one who owned a watch, was elected timekeeper, and they gathered around where the dying man lay, either urging him to give up the useless struggle or pleading with him raucously to hang on a little longer. When he went into back-arching convulsions, with his eyes rolled up into his skull, his jaws locked into a grinning rictus, and he lost control of his sphincter muscle, Camacho knelt beside him, holding a bunch of smouldering tambuti leaves under his nostrils, to shock him out of it, and crooning, 10 minutes more, hang on for just 10 minutes more, for your old friend Machito." The last convulsion ended with a dreadful gangling expulsion of breath, and when the heartbeat faded completely, Camacho stood and kicked the corpse with disgust. He was always a dung-eating jackal. When they began to strip the corpse of all items of any possible value, 5 coins, heavy golden mohurs of the East India Company, fell out of the folds of his turban. There was not one man in all that company who would not have willingly sold his mother into slavery for a single gold mohur, let alone 5. At the first gleam of gold, all their knives came out with a sardonic metallic snickering, and the first man to snatch for the treasure reeled away, trying to push his intestines back into the long, clean slice through his stomach wall. "Leave them lie," Camacho shouted. "Don't touch them until the lots are drawn." Not one of them trusted another, and the knives stayed out while the lots were cast, and grudgingly the winners were allowed one at a time to claim their prize. The man with the belly wound could not march without his stomach falling out. And because he could not march, he was as good as dead. The dead, as everybody knows, have no need of personal possessions. The logic was apparent to all. They left him his shirt and breeches, both torn and badly stained anyway, but stripped him of all else as they stripped the first corpse. Then, with a few ribald pleasantries, they propped him against the base of the marula tree, with the naked corpse of the snake-bite victim beside him for company, and they marched away along the line of the escarpment.